a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is Thursday, December the 5th, 2024, and that means it's time for an expert counsel Q&A show of the week. Here's what I have for you. Number one, we need to get rid of Ned. Who's Ned? Ned's not a who, it's a what. It's the deep state's regime change machine, and this will be handled by Dan McAdams and Ron Paul of the Liberty Report for the Liberty Report highlights of the week. And then we will have a really nice send-off, Sean Mills' last expert counsel segment of the show, unless something changes in the future. If he ever wants to come back, the door will always be open. But he's going to talk about existing systems and DIY solar. And again, for those who hadn't heard before, Sean is not leaving because of any animosity or anything. He got some company came up to him and said, here's some money. And he said, I'm independent now. I don't want money from you. And they said, here's more money. And every man has a point where they go, I'll take that money and go do something. So he's got a full-time job again where he's working for somebody else. So he doesn't have time to be doing these anymore. Andy and good for him, by the way. I'm very happy for Sean. He seems like he has landed something really, really great. Andy McCann will talk about exercises to prepare for and recover from a knee replacement surgery. And this just shows how proactive and helpful Andy is as a person. This is actually for Mama Sauce. This is Nicole Sauce's mama. She's about to have knee replacement surgery. He talked to her a lot at the workshop this November. And this segment came from that. Carrie Brown will talk about two herbs you can forage. Jack, if you look outside, I know you live in Texas, but it's winter, it's cold. It is, but in a lot of the country, there's two herbs that you can forage right now and deep into winter, honestly. Not all the country, but a lot of the country. Dr. Ken Berry will talk about dealing with recurring stomach viruses. Chef Ken Daniels will give you some kick-ass eggnog recipes and ideas, and I am a pro-nogger, not an anti-nogger, and you might be, what the hell does that mean? I will explain it to you when we get to Ken's segment. It is a thing, and it happens on X, formerly Twitter, every year. It seems that the nog wars have died down since the election. I'm not sure why, because the old nog season starts, yes, at Thanksgiving, but it really peaks at Christmas, and there is something called the Nog Wars, and I think if you're an anti-nogger, then Ken is right, you haven't had actual real eggnog made the right way. Nicholas Ferguson will talk to us about guerrilla gardening, and I'm going to talk to you about something that happened last night. Bitcoin hit 100K. Yay, yay, 100K. Laser eyes to 100K. Maxis are removing their laser eyes from their icons on X, on Bitcoin, Twitter, X, whatever it is. What should we do next? Hodlers, people that have been holding Bitcoin a long time. We had this big milestone, $100,000. Wow, what do you do next? Well, I think most of you already know what I'm going to say, but I'll save it until it's my turn to anchor the show today. With that, before we get into this, let's go ahead and remind you guys a couple ways you can help support this show. One would be to do your online shopping beginning at tspaz.com. You're probably buying lots of stuff right now. It is the Christmas season, etc. Please do me a favor. If you're going to shop online, just go there first and use the links there. And if you're buying from Vavor, use the discount code and get more money off. And if you're buying from Amazon, I don't have a discount code from you, but you still help me out and you're going to buy the same stuff anyway. You can also see all the things that I recommend there and that I've reviewed. And remember, if I recommend it and reviewed it, I'd buy it again, I'd spend my money on it, or I wouldn't recommend it to you. That's just how I do things. I have two items of the day this week. One was Vavor stainless steel work table. This is a 36 long, 24 wide work surface table, about 3 foot high. It's a great working height. It has really great wheel casters on it, so you can move it around. It would make a fantastic temporary island in your kitchen. I'm just saying, and I'm going to add a link to the show notes today to something I should have brought back around for Thanksgiving and didn't, Vavor's food warming box. It would sit right on this, too, I'm just saying. This, the food warming box, I didn't bring it around this week, I will next week. I have to tell you, it made my Thanksgiving freaking easy peasy. It will hold 8 half-size disposable aluminum pans covered with foil. So as everything got heated up, warmed up, or cooked, I wrapped them in foil and threw them in there. I had to feed 14 people, one oven, and it was so damn easy because of that. So the table, and we'll just throw the hot box in as a bonus. It's really cool. And then the Hamilton Beach 3-in-1 egg cooker, that's on Amazon. $20, about 50 of you guys have already bought one of these, just from me mentioning it one day. It is fantastic. Now, I will tell you, I finally tried the poach egg feature in it. I went for medium. It was a little over for me. I'll have to experiment with the water. But making the omelets and then the hard-boiled eggs with it is fantastic. And the hard-boiled eggs peel like you're peeling a banana. It is, and I'm talking fresh eggs, you know, right from under the chicken or duck's butt. And that's one of the hacks. If you ever have trouble peeling eggs, part of it is if you let your eggs go a few weeks after you harvest them, some of the moisture evaporates out, puts more space in the shell. If you use this thing, it will not matter. And the deviled egg recipe that goes along with that review is fire. Instead of mayo, I'm using avocado mash along with bacon and jalapeno. These were the bomb. We made a whole bunch of them. They did not make it 2 days. My wife and I smashed them all. But if you've ever been frustrated peeling an egg and you want a way to do this without no grief, and the holiday season is a good time for deviled eggs, I'm just saying you might want to check it out. With that, let's go ahead and dive on into it. Dan McAdams and Ron Paul on Let's Throw Ned Right Out the Door. Who's Ned? Again, Ned's not a who, he's a what.
We want to talk a little bit about an article that we found fascinating, and that has to do some, we want to pass on some modest advice.
Yeah.
Modest advice to the Department of Government Efficiency. You know, they've been sort of invited me to say a word or two.
Yeah, absolutely.
You and I have talked about it. We think it would be a real achievement. We've been working on this for a few years,
yes,
haven't we?
A few years.
And we didn't achieve it back in the 80s. We didn't get rid of anything, but we called attention to it. So here it is dealing with the National Endowment for Democracy.
Yeah.
And our suggestion is very simple. Get rid of it.
Yeah.
We don't need it. And I've been quoted as saying, but these are radical quotes. I can't imagine them putting out on public, getting rid of the CIA and the FBI. I mean, that's radical stuff. But more people are starting to think that way.
Yeah.
So
this is an article written by our good friend Kelly Vlahos. We've known her for a long time. And it's in the American Conservative magazine. It's been out for a couple of days, and it's a very, very, very good article, as are all her articles. Doja's best first target, the National Endowment for Democracy. She makes a great case, which we'll go into. But you're right, Dr. Paul, this is really low-hanging fruit. Now, the history of the National Endowment for Democracy is kind of a sad one in a way, because these are remember when the left all migrated to Reagan in the 80s, you know, they became the neocons who pushed Reagan to be more aggressive. They were the ones who were furious when Reagan went to Reykjavik. They didn't want him talking to Gorbachev. They didn't want any kind of a deal to end the Cold War or to tone down the nuclear weapons against each other. They were furious. And so this is the one thing that they demanded. Set up a national endowment for democracy, and we can spread democracy through the world. And of course, in the context of the Cold War, it sounded good. We will get rid of those godless communists by democratizing everything. Well, in practice, as with everything the neocons get their hands on, it turned to dirt, or something worse than dirt. I won't even say the word. So anyway, it spends a ton of money. Go to the next clip. They get a ton of money each year. Now, it's not DOD-level money, but what they do with that money is so harmful, it may even be worse. Now, this is what Kelly writes. The new Department of Government Efficiency should seriously consider the National Endowment Democracy for its high priority list of federal cost-cutting measures in 2025. It's not only a sinkhole of American taxpayer dollars, over $1 billion in appropriations, but its mission to promote freedom over the world has for decades translated into countless cases of counterproductive meddling that puts truly organic movements at risk, and it foments regime change. So that's actually the interesting part of the National Endowment for Democracy. Not only does it not help American interests, it actually hurts American interests overseas.
So I think it's really going to be a very improbable thing that we ever see the day that the FBI has gotten rid of. And I think part of that is that you can probably make a case that most people would agree with. I'm not saying it's right, but you can probably make a case that most people would agree with, that the FBI serves a legitimate purpose. Maybe it's too big, maybe it has too much power. So I think you might get FBI reform under Cash Patel. The problem is we always know how that works. Even if they really do reform it, when you leave a cancer tumor in place, you only get rid of part of it, the tumor grows back, and as soon as whatever treatment you're using to suppress it either stops working or wears out or it stops being used, not only does it grow back, it grows back faster and more lethal than ever. So that's what I see for the future of the FBI. Maybe things get better for a while and worse long term. Getting rid of the CIA would be like exterminating all the cockroaches on the planet. It's a great idea that probably will never happen, because the CIA operates in a way that I think if the average American understood how the CIA actually operated, they would be for getting rid of it. But the average American's an idiot that likes to read things like Brad Thor novels and think that they're real, and then turn around and say, but we need them to protect us from the Russians or whatever the boogeyman of the day is. When what the CIA really is a force of disorder throughout the world. It is order out of chaos. Have you ever heard that before, right? Order from chaos. So they seek the order they want through the dissemination of chaos throughout the world. For all our talk of Russian interference in the elections, the Russians use some bot farms and bought some advertising and run their media propaganda campaign like every other country in the world does. We literally topple governments. We go in and we use money and power and influence, soft and hard power both, and we topple entire legitimate governments. And then we have the audacity to say, my Putin got Trump elected, like a bunch of idiots, like an actual bunch of idiots. But the reality of how the CIA works is you could literally get rid of, like, just get rid of the CIA. There's no director of the CIA. The CIA is officially disavowed as an American. They're self-funding at this point. There's hundreds of companies across the globe that are actually CIA fronts. They are the number one importer of drugs, and they're probably the number one disseminator of, like, you know, human trafficking in the world. They're going to make their money one way or another because what they do, and I really believe the average person in the CIA believes it's necessary, believes that it's important, believes that even though we do this evil shit because we have to. I think that's part of the program, and I think the way that the CIA works right now, there's a front door that people enter into to become agents, but what happens after they go through that front door is a programming process, and I think that they select people who in the beginning are incredibly ethical, having talked to some people who quit, okay, or are former agents, and then that very ethical mindset is used to create someone who will act without ethics because they believe it's ethical. It is a mind fuck beyond words. And they do shit like get a foreign person, somebody at an embassy or something, to do them a favor. It's a favor. It's not illegal, but it's maybe something they probably shouldn't have done. And then they lean on them, and they get them to do more, and they get them to keep doing more. And then they do things like, you know, show them a picture of their child that just got a DUI because magically a cop knew exactly where they were and pulled their car over instead of anybody else's car over. Don't know how that happened. And they say, we can make it all go away, or your kid can go to jail in France as a foreign national or something like that. This is the way this sleazebag organization operates. And I'm all for curtailing it, but if I told you that there is a reasonable expectation that it could actually be gotten rid of, I would be lying to you, and I don't do that. So let's move on to something a little bit more proactive and a little bit more uplifting, given the time of year we're in and all, and things we can do for ourselves, because here's the takeaway from this, and it's kind of the big takeaway from the show I did with John and Nicole on Tuesday. Whatever they do, I'm going to keep building my business, building my community, building my homestead, working on my independence and freedom, and helping other people do just that. So one way we could do that with that is alternative energy, not to save the polar bears, but to save ourselves the hassle of being interfered with or being under somebody else's control, or to give us more options like, hey, I can buy that piece of land over there even though it doesn't have electrical service because I can DIY my own electrical system. On that, let's hear from Sean Mills.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got a couple answers for you. The first one is a question from Brian. Brian says, will the system built in this video be a viable option for emergency power? And he links to one of Will Prowse's videos where Will just connects an all-in-one inverter to a server rack battery. And he says, I've watched all the videos you did on on building your own solar generator, and I have been looking at various designs. I found this video on YouTube, and it seems like a fairly similar system to the one you put together. Are the server rack batteries he uses and the all-in-one system, I'm assuming a charge controller / inverter combo, a viable option for emergency power? Thanks for all you do. Yes, absolutely. All you need is a battery source, which allows you to store power for use when you need it, an inverter, which takes that DC stored power and turns it into AC power for your appliances, and some sort of charge controller. So that can be an AC charge controller where you just plug it into the wall. It can be a DC charge controller in the form of coming from an alternator if it's a battery system that's attached to a vehicle, or from a solar panel, for example. I love the all-in-one inverters because they have an AC charger, a DC charger, and an inverter all in one function. So all you have to add is a battery for it to work, and then you can choose how to recharge those systems. They also have pass-through functionality, meaning that You can plug the AC in and have that pass through and power AC loads on the other side, and then use extra AC available power to charge the battery up. And the reason why I like that idea is that you could literally build one of these systems, plug it into a wall, keep it up, and in the event that your power goes out, you just plug stuff into it. Like you take stuff that's plugged in somewhere else and you plug it into this device. These batteries are generally in the $1,200 range. That's a 48 volt nominal, but it's really a 51.2 to 58 volt battery, and it runs with a typically 100 amp BMS, so it can charge or discharge at 100 amps. Now, I wouldn't suggest using 100 amps on one battery, but it is actually capable of doing that. You're just gonna, you know, if you discharge it that fast or charge it that fast, particularly at the ends of the charge spectrum, you're going to create problems for yourself. So, but one of these batteries with, you know, an all-in-one, say, 3,500 watt inverter, which is going to be incapable of pulling more than 100 amps, that is a pretty standard system. I've done a bunch of RV systems this year, and that's literally what the system I've used is based on: one battery and a 3,500 watt 120 volt all-in-one inverter. I like the one from Renogy. There's another one from Signature Solar that EG4 makes. It's really nice, and that's what I would go with. It's super easy. You can be into one of these systems for, you know, $3,000 with the battery, with the inverter, with a case for it, with all your wires, and then you can go buy some cheap solar panels somewhere, keep them in your garage, and only use them when you need them. Like, I built one of these systems for my wife's uncle down in Florida, and that's what he's going to do. He's going to store his solar panels in his shed, and then when he needs to use those for power charging, he's going to put them on top of his shed, and boom, he's got a self-contained power system. So thanks for the question, Brian. Here's another one. This comes in from Dylan. Dylan says, what are some key factors to look for in an off-grid homestead in regards to existing power system and the ability to grow? Without going into a ton of details here, they're essentially buying a system with a small 8 solar panel, 4 kilowatt inverter system that's already installed with a 12,000 watt whole house generator. And then the follow-on question is adding wind power in Montana feasible? So let's just cover those. Number one, and I've said this before, but I would rarely trust an existing system. I wouldn't add any value to the price of the system I wouldn't add any value to the house based on an existing system unless It's a system that's grid tied and actively putting power back on the grid. And that agreement, that interconnection agreement, is transferable to you. So in that case, okay, now there's an actual value to the, to that system that can be documented. And in that case, I would do it. But, you know, some little small off-grid deal, I would not assume that that's built properly and that I'm going to get a ton of value out of it. I might be able to repurpose some of the components, but I just, like I said, I would not generally add a ton of value to a small system like this. But it sounds like at least there's infrastructure in place where you can add to it pretty easily. Okay. If they've got a 12,000 watt whole house generator, then they probably got infrastructure for feeding 12,000 watts into the house, right? Well, great. That's a 50 amp inverter. And so, you know, I might look at adding a 50 amp inverter to this and running the generator input into the inverter, adding some batteries, adding some solar panels down the road. And now I can actually run my house off of this inverter and use the generator for backup and then use the grid as like backup. And then the other thing is, you know, for the wind, Montana is one of the few places where wind is a good idea. And so, you know, I would look into that. I don't deal with wind a ton, just because the vast majority of the United States is not a good idea. But Montana is one of the few places, there are areas in Montana where it does make sense. And at a home scale, being in very cold areas isn't necessarily a problem. When you're, you know, when you're building a 200 foot tall, you know, wind tower with 80 foot blades, you know, 380 foot blades and a nacelle that's as big as a shipping container, well, then cold weather can cause problems for you, as Texas found out a couple years back. But at home scale, most of the time, it's not a problem. If you're going to put big, super high draw loads on a system, I do like the idea of a separate system. So let's say you want a small system for your house, and then you want a separate system for, you know, a shop where you're going to be doing some welding or, you know, other high draw items. I like the idea of there being a separate system for that that can actually be supplemented from the main house system, because then you're building a system that's meant for that one job, and you're not oversizing your house system. But since your house system is working all day and it's probably attached to your larger solar array, you can use excess generation on the house side and push that over to a shop to top up the batteries on that system, so that when you go into your high draw appliances, you're okay. The biggest thing to remember when anytime you're trying to run high draw appliances off of a solar system is you've got to look at how much you're drawing out of the batteries and make sure that, you know, you're okay there. So if you've got a 48 volt system and you're running a 240 volt appliance, 10 amps at 240 volts is going to be 50 amps at 48 volts. Okay. And so that means 100 amps at 240 volts is going to be 500 amps at 48 volts. And so you got to make sure that all of that wiring and your batteries themselves are capable of that high draw without damaging themselves. That's the biggest thing to look for there. All right, guys, keep getting those questions in the jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
I have nothing there to add to what Sean had to say. I just want to say a very heartfelt thank you to Sean Mills for years of service to this community, not just as a member of the expert panel, but as a community member as a whole that has helped a tremendous number of people. And I'm sure that part won't change, though he may be around a little bit less with some of the obligations to his new job. Sean has been around so long that I remember a much younger Sean Mills back in 2013, hustling pool at the first ever TSP workshop, which would have been around April or May of 2013. That is a long time to be helping people. And he was helping before that. That's just the first time I got to meet him face-to-face in real life. So, Sean, thank you so much, sir, for everything you've done for the show, for our community, for our sub-communities, for Nicole Sauce's community at Living Free in Tennessee. All of it, man. Thank you so much. We will endeavor to go on without you and find someone to fill the niches that you covered, but you will never be replaced. With that, let's hear from Annie McCann about exercises to help with recovery from a full-on knee replacement surgery.
This is Andy McCann helping you lay a firm foundation in fitness, food, and finances, mostly fitness and food for you guys here on the TSBC community. So you guys know that I am out of Woodstock, Georgia. If you were here locally, come to the gym, CrossFit Garage. If you're not here locally, we have Garage Fitness Online where everyone can get a free 2 months. You kind of need to have your own setup either in your garage or your basement. So it's basically all of the things I normally do just online. You can find me on all the podcasts, Food, Fitness, and Finance, as well as on YouTube at AndyMcCann42. And, of course, I guess I don't know when this will come out, but you can come see the recent additions to Jack's live stream. You can see all the presentations that were given. I did one there for them called Five Pillars of Health and Longevity. I'll probably redo that one in portions on my side, on my podcast. So you can go there and find it. Today, I am going to talk about knee replacement surgery. So I had a lot of great questions. It was an awesome time. Actually, let me start off with this. If you guys are longtime listeners, never callers like I was for, I don't know, like 10, 15 years, I really just started getting involved maybe a year or two ago and trying to give back to the community. After several Jack U jerks, this is where I'm at. I'm doing some things and I just want to help out. So that's what I'm doing. But going to the Self-Reliance Festival, with Nicole Sauce and then the TSP Fall Workshop was awesome. Met a whole lot of people that, man, guys, if you're not involved, you're missing out. You need to come to some of this stuff. Yes, I know the tickets for the Fall Festival are hard to get a hold of, but there's other things you can go to. There's the, the Self-Reliance Festival. There's several that Nicole does. There's stuff that John does. There's just get involved. Find your people. If you're not sure who to find, ask around and they will hook you up. Okay, so knee surgery. This is what we're talking about today. Mama Sauce said, hey, in a couple months, I'm going to replace one knee and then I'll replace another knee. Let's talk. And so I'm not going to give you specifics on hers, but I'm going to take it as a generalistic approach and tell you some things that I would be doing from the health and fitness side. So we talked a little bit about using fitness to push your biometric, your measurements, into a higher degree of awesomeness. So if you're well, then your heart rate is about 75 beats per minute resting. If you're fit, it's probably somewhere like 50 to 60. That, so you can kind of think on the side of, if I get sick, or when I get sick, and my heart has to work harder, then I am just moving into what people would consider well, right? So if I'm at 50 beats per minute, and it, you know, knocks up an extra 20 beats, I'm actually still like in the norm of like, well, in normal people. But if you're normal and have 72 and it goes up by 20 beats per minute because you're under stress or sick or whatever, then you're at 90 or 100 and that's not great. So what I would like for you guys to be able to see in this is you can prepare yourself, knee surgery specific right now, but you can prepare yourself for anything by adding health and fitness. Okay, so the story kind of went along the lines of I'm getting a knee replacement surgery. I waited as long as I possibly could. Now what? And that would probably be my first advice for knee surgery or any of this stuff. But I'm going to focus on knees is wait for as long as you can until you really need to do it. So don't just jump in there. Typically, 99% of you guys is going to be, hey, lose weight. And that's going to be probably the best thing you could do to create a longer window of having your own knee. Okay. If you have to do it, and, you know, it's going to be soon no matter what you do. Still, losing weight is probably the biggest thing you can do. The best way you can lose weight is simply editing the way you eat. I told this to everyone before. I like to do spoilers when I do a presentation. So the spoiler words, get connected and eat carnivore. There's so many awesome things that come out of carnivore. One of them being there's going to be weight loss. I'm going to have to look you up real quick. David out of Florida, who went on carnivore and lost 80 pounds in about 9 months. Guys, this stuff is real. He was, David, you were what, like 6'8"? I don't know. You were huge. You're so tall. Maybe 6'4". But me at 5'6 or 5'8", everyone looks tall. Anyway, carnivore works. Lose weight. Your knees and your hips and all those supporting joints are going to be so much happier with you if you're simply not making every single stand-up, sit-down, move left and right, all the movement, heavier by whatever the weight is. So first thing is to lose some weight. Next thing you want to be doing is increasing the range of motion of what you can do without pain. I mean, push through some of it maybe, and increase the strength around that joint. So one thing you can do for your knee is I guess I've been talking at too high a level sometimes. Like, hey, do these squats below parallel, etc. Most people can't even squat right. So I'm going to back it up and tell you, Google on YouTube, I guess Google on YouTube, that's weird. Search on YouTube squat therapy. Put maybe CrossFit in there and they're going to show you some squat therapy. Another one is door jam squatting. So basically what you're going to do is hook your fingers around the door jam and then you're going to drop yourself down into a great squat. If you don't know what a squat is, Google or... search on YouTube a video from CrossFit and proper squat. You're going to see exactly what you need to do. And you can use the door jam to help facilitate the range of motion as well as the, uh-oh, I can't get there because I'm either maybe my knees are too feeble or I'm just not strong enough. I haven't done this in a long time. So build back up to it. You can also do it with a pole. You can use, you know, it doesn't have to be a door jam, but if you have a pole, make sure you don't dance on it and you want to, you know, climb yourself up. Yep, Tammy, that was for you. Did you understand what I just did there? Stupid dad joke, right? So that's inside joke for like six of you. Anyway, losing weight, adding range of motion, and adding strength. I would do the raw squatting, but then I would also, once you start getting good at it, you can do a thing like add a weight vest if you don't want to hold on to something. If your positioning gets good, then you could add maybe dumbbells in your hands if you don't need to hold on to something, or put them on your shoulders, or get a bar and squat with a bar. Probably the best thing you could do out of all of this is join a gym that has a one-person owner and a couple coaches, because they really want you to be successful, like a CrossFit gym or something like that, and ask them to help you prepare for this surgery. They totally will. They know what to do. These guys are usually awesome. If you're not sure what to join, email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com. Send me some roughly where you are or some websites that you're looking at, and I'll go through those with you guys. All right, guys, I'm here to help you lay that firm foundation of fitness, food, and some finances. If you need me, you know where to find me. Take care.
Good stuff from Andy, as always. As always. And I can't tell you how good a dude Andy is, like in real life, like just a good man. He's a bit energetic in that way. You're like, okay, calm down, pal. But this is a man who truly wants to help people, and he extends the offer to help anybody that is remotely open to getting that help. So with that, let's move on to Kerry Brown, another really great dude, to talk to us about foraging herbs even in the wintertime.
Hey, TSP community, Kerry Brown here with Strong Roots Resources, and I've got a couple of herbs for foraging today that I wanted to tell you guys about. I picked these two out because while a lot of our annuals and perennials are beginning to go dormant, these two particular continue to stand out even through the wintertime, at least here in the southeast. So let's dive into both of those. First one is lyre leaf sage. That's L-Y-R-E, like the instrument. Lyre leaf sage is actually in the mint family. This is a small plant with a basal rosette that pretty much hugs the ground. This is not anything that's going to be bushy or really... The only reason to me this stands out is because this thing starts popping with color when everything else is more or less brown. So, lyre leaf sage is a native North American wildflower and has a lot of traditional uses in herbal medicine, although for whatever reason it's not as well documented as some others. So, long list here. First is as a wound healer. You can use the leaves as a poultice to treat cuts, scrapes, and minor wounds. And it seems that there is some antimicrobial properties of those leaves. So if you've hurt yourself and you're not close to your comfrey patch, this is another option for you. Like a lot of the sages, you can brew this into a tea for taking care of respiratory issues such as coughs and colds. It does have anti-inflammatory properties, mostly within topical applications. And can also be used as a mild astringent for skin irritations, oily skin, if you want to use it as like a wash or a compress. So I chose this because through most of the summer, this plant doesn't really show up too much. And if I do find it, it's very, very small, maybe not much bigger than a silver dollar. But as the weather cools, other things die back. this plant kind of changes from a medium green to it starts to get pinks and purples showing out, and it flowers in early spring. So this is most commonly found in kind of marginal soils. The place where it really pops up for me is a, this would be a southeast facing corner of pasture that really is not in good condition. It's somewhat compacted, it's very, very rocky, there's not a lot of organic matter in the soil right there, and that's where this plant likes to be. So that's kind of where you want to be looking. It does like a pretty much full sun. It will tolerate some shade. It seems like as soon as the soil improves, that plant is not hanging out anymore. So I have tried to transplant it. I've tried to transplant it several times into my nicer gardens, and it's just not happy there. So I just let it hang out where it wants to be for now. The second plant I wanted to bring to your attention is yarrow. In other parts of the U.S., sometimes we say yarrow. And this is another native herb, native wildflower. And this plant kind of looks like, it's kind of delicate looking. It has fern-like foliage. There are varieties that you can buy that have all kinds of, beautiful colors when they bloom, just pinks and oranges and bright red. And I have, not to come down on this plant, but I have plain old white flowering sage, or not sage, but yarrow around here. But it's a darn useful plant. So yarrow is another option for controlling bleeding. The leaves actually are styptic, so they will actually aid in blood clotting. You can pluck off, kind of a section of the fern, roll it up, and apply it to where you have just tangled with the blackberries, and it will speed up the clotting of the blood. There is also some evidence that it has antimicrobial activities. And you can also use it for digestive health via making a tea, for menstrual support, anti-inflammatory uses, kind of more so it seems to be in the in terms of like arthritis or skin irritations, and that's being cited as both internal and external use. Fever reduction, there's evidence that you can use it to lower a mild fever naturally, and also as kind of a general immune support and a sedative to help handle stress and anxiety. So this is one that's just super useful throughout. It tends to inhabit some of the same soil conditions as the lyre leaf sage, but this was one that I've successfully been able to transplant into my gardens. With the caveat, should you choose to do that, it will go bonkers on you. I would treat it as sternly as I would perhaps planting mints or something like that. It can most certainly fill out. It can take up a lot of space. So take that into account. Be ready to control it or keep it potted or whatever the case may be. It spreads by rhizomes as well as the seed. So that's two plants to look out for here as a lot of stuff starts to go dormant. And if I can help you answer foraging questions on your land, help you understand the plants and what they mean about your land, feel free to reach out to me anytime. That's Carrie Brown with Strong Roots Resources, strongrootsresources@gmail.com. And we will talk to you guys next time.
Good stuff from Carrie. And I just want to say, I think learning plants that are useful in your area is a skill that every person that calls themselves a homesteader, a modern survivalist, a prepper, anything like that really should learn. And honestly, I think everybody should. We have been gifted with a miraculous planet, and there are so many things that are nutritious, so many things that are medicinal, and they are freely available in return only for a little bit of effort and the acquisition of knowledge. And we're fortunate to have people like Carrie and the other expert panel members that help us with the acquisition of knowledge. All we have to do then is go act on that knowledge and begin to become better at what we do, become more of a polymath. This is one of the polymath skills, as far as I'm concerned, that it's great to specialize in something and be really good at it, but it's also great to have a broad knowledge. And this is one of the things that's so universal, there's no reason not to do it. And on that note, if you want help learning more about any of the things that we talk about, I need questions for the expert counsel to help them help you. So email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, put TSPC expert in the subject line, say, this question is for expert counsel member, whoever it is, return, so there's a space there. My question is, one sentence, ?, return, details. That formula, trust me, I've been doing this 16 and a half years. That formula not only will be likely to get me to send the question forward, because I'll read it and understand it, you will get a better answer. I'm not being a dick. I'm trying to help. I really am. Anyway, let's move on and hear from Doc Ken Berry on recurrent stomach viruses.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Dr. Ken Berry answering a question today from Caleb. Caleb is a 30-something-year-old male, is mostly carnivore, has some greens every now and then for variety, generally in good health, but sometimes he has a stomach virus. And so this is for everybody with the stomach virus, nausea, vomiting, unable to eat solid food, gastroenteritis type situations. So the conventional wisdom is to eat bananas, rice, crackers, applesauce, drink Gatorade. That's completely counterproductive. That's going to spike your blood sugar, which is in no way going to help your body fight the virus off. The quickest and easiest way to do this, if you're in a pinch, is to buy some sugar-free Gatorade. You can also, in many pharmacies, buy electrolyte powders that are sugar-free and just mix that with water. A lot of people think that if they are throwing up that they need IV fluid, somehow that'll be magic, but the medical research is very clear that if you're able to keep fluids down by mouth, then that's always the preferable way to rehydrate and to fight against dehydration. I've got a YouTube video on my channel about how to make what we call Keterade, which is basically a sugar-free electrolyte liquid. You can buy the unflavored Element or Salty or Ultima, which is going to give you all the salt and electrolytes you need. Keep in mind that your stomach absorbs water and electrolytes very, very quickly. So if you're, let's say you're throwing up every 10 or 15 minutes, you'll have your electrolyte replacement fluid ready. As soon as you throw up, you're going to start sipping on that, and you're not going to throw up again for 10, 15, 20 minutes. And when you do throw up, it'll look like you threw up all that liquid, but you didn't. You absorbed probably 70% of that. So keep that in mind, that you can always outrun dehydration with an electrolyte fluid. You don't necessarily need IV fluids. Hope this helps. Talk to you guys next time. This is Dr. Berry.
So I'm not going to add anything as to what to do when you have a stomach virus that's causing a lot of nausea and vomiting beyond what Ken gave, because basically viruses are treat the symptoms and let the body fight the illness. When I got this email, though, I got to tell you that my gut was that this person's getting more stomach viruses than you would expect. Okay, so what I mean is, like, we all will pick something up here and there, but this seems like a recurrent thing. And I would suggest that maybe you might want to get in touch with Dr. Stephen Lewis, who we do discounts for his services in the MSB. And you may want to discuss with him getting some panels done to take a look at your levels of certain things, like your vitamin D levels, some of your micronutrient and your mineral levels and things like that. Because if this is like, hey, I just want to know when I get a virus and I'm wrong, then don't worry about this. If you're getting sick 5, 6, 7 times a year or something like this, there's something not right. And carnivore's great, ketovore's great. I recommend it, but it is possible that based on the way you're doing it, there may be a deficiency beyond a simple electrolyte deficiency, because that will make things worse with the dehydration, but it shouldn't be leading to getting more viruses. In the world of medicine, we have two worlds, and they seem to be at odds with each other, and I consider both sides myopic. One's germ theory and one is terrain theory. And what people say is if you have an illness in your fish tank, you don't, you know, treat the illness with drugs, you clean the tank. And if you are a germ theory, then you just treat it with some sort of chemicals or drugs. As someone who has kept tropical fish for 40 years of my freaking life, that is a stupid analogy because you know what you do? Depending on what the problem is, you do both. You do both. If you actually have something like an infestation of a very common thing known as ick, cleaning your tank won't do jack shit. What you do is you raise the temperature, okay? Basically, you give the tank a fever high enough to accelerate the life cycle of the parasite, and you salinate the water to the level that your fish can handle, but the spores in the interim cannot. And there are other things that you might have going on in your tank where, yes, you'll clean the tank, but you also might use an antibiotic for a brief period of time and then reestablish the microbiome of the tank. And so I think that when we have an illness, especially anything that continually recurs, especially when we are otherwise living a healthy lifestyle, that we need to look for what the deficiency might be and identify it. And you might find that it's something that you need to supplement temporarily while you add something to your diet and reduce the deficiency to the point where the diet can take care of it. Because when somebody says we're eating carnivore, Ken's like, well, you're getting all the nutrients you need from red meat, but are you eating as much red meat as Ken does? You see what I'm saying? Like a lot on carnivore, you're eating chicken. And ain't nothing wrong with chicken, but if you're eating mostly chicken, you're probably deficient in some nutrients. If you're not eating any organ meats, you're probably deficient in some nutrients. If you're not getting enough physical activity and being outside enough, you may find deficiency in vitamin D. And I just smell this here. I would suggest that you get your vitamin D level checked, and if it's something like 40 or 45 and your doctor's like, oh, it's fine, your doctor's retarded and he doesn't know the history of vitamin D. He probably doesn't know it's not a vitamin, it's actually a freaking hormone, but he probably doesn't know that the safe level of vitamin D in the human body is about 300. And when doctors and scientists first discovered it in the 20s and 30s as we were heading up to World War fucking II and they had to accelerate everything, they determined that the safe level was about 300, but they weren't sure and they wanted to be safe, so they just cut it by a third and knew that if you were up over 30, a kid wouldn't get rickets. So this is dumb. Your vitamin D level should be somewhere at least between 80 and 120. And 120 is not dangerous. And if you have a doctor that tells you it is, I promise you if you do your own research, you will find out what I told you is true. And then you need to ask yourself why you have a fucking doctor that doesn't know what a redneck hippie duck farming podcaster does. Because I'm telling you, I will lay money on what I just told you. Lots of money. I'll bet a fucking Bitcoin that there is not a doctor in this audience or a doctor that you know in this audience that can prove that a vitamin D level of 150 is actually fucking dangerous at any level whatsoever. Not with some book that's saying it, but show me the research that shows a person had a problem in their life at all directly correlated to a vitamin D rating of 150, let's say. And you won't find one. You'll find lots of people that say it, but none of them will take the bet because they're all full of shit. And when it comes right down to it, they know it, and they just do what they're told to do primarily by insurance companies. Yeah, and you wonder why an insurance executive just got his dome peeled by somebody with a suppressed pistol in New York City. My guess is that, and I'm not advocating what the man did, but if you don't know, the CEO of UnitedHealthcare, largest insurer in the country, just got freaking assassinated, literally assassinated by somebody. Three shots from a kind of an 8-up, 9mm, I think what it was, suppressed by dude with a hoodie and a face mask on right in downtown New York City. And the bullet casing said something like delay, deny, depose, which is almost the title of a book on insurance companies not paying. And we can't figure out why it happened. Yeah, the cabal of the insurance companies and big pharma together cannot be trusted. And your doctor, I don't care how trustworthy they are as a person, on some level is on their leash. And you need to take responsibility for your own health. And that went longer than I planned. And it really, I never even thought I was going to bring up the shooting of that gentleman. But it is what it is. Let's move on and talk about eggnog. because after thinking of all this, I could use a drink.
Hello, everyone. This is Ken with DrinkEatLearn.com. Today's question comes from Jack Spierko. He asks, Ken, can you come up with some kick-ass eggnog recipes? I absolutely am paraphrasing for Jack, but he and I were chatting about eggnog at the Fall Workshop, and he mentioned it again in the most recent Expert Council segment, so this is an easy topic because I love eggnog. There's nothing better this time of year. I've experimented with eggnog for years. More so, I love teaching about eggnog, and I know I can already hear some of the groans and grumblings coming from you anti-noggers. That's the name given to those who are defiantly against eggnog. I believe if you don't like eggnog, you've simply never had real eggnog. I'm not talking about store-bought eggnog. I'm talking about raw egg, aged for weeks, if not months, potentially years, eggnog. And let's get into it. There's several ways to make eggnog, and for me, it's always raw eggs, and there's no debate. I only use yolks, but there are tons of recipes using egg whites folded in. I have found throughout the years I do not like the texture when using egg whites for aged eggnog. And yes, we'll be using raw eggs, so you'll need to take some safety measures. And if this makes you squeamish, but you're going out to local speakeasies and drinking whiskey sours with egg whites, then you really don't have an excuse. I use all kinds of eggs, though I prefer duck eggs. The yolks are rich, and the flavor and texture carries over very well to the eggnog. Even using quail eggs can make a very lighter, delicate version. If anyone has ostrich eggs, I'd love to see an aged eggnog, how that would taste. That's certainly a lot of nog, and reach out to me if you want to donate an egg. For this discussion, I'll be simplifying eggnog into two categories, raw aged and cooked. We could debate this for days, but in the context, let's roll with this concept. For me, true eggnog should be made with raw eggs and always aged for at least a couple of weeks. Sure, you can make raw eggnog and drink it immediately, but I think you're missing the point. Aging is what makes this cocktail so unique. The second technique is cooked nog. This is where you cook eggs slowly to kill off any potential harmful bacteria. For me, it's just something called crème anglaise. That's French for thickened sweet egg cream. And if you've made ice cream, the base liquid to ice cream is crème anglaise. In fact, your grocery store is out of cartons. Eggnog, head to the ice cream aisle, pick your favorite vanilla flavor. You know the one, corn syrup, tons of junk. Listen, I'm trying to teach you some holiday survival skills, damn it. Sometimes you've got to make some sacrifices. Go home, melt it, add some nutmeg, definitely add some booze, mix it up in a mason jar, and let it sit in the fridge for a couple of days. You'd be surprised. And here's why. I've discussed it before. Ethanol loves fat and water-based liquids. Letting even crappy melted ice cream age with alcohol will enhance the flavor. It gets creamier, and the alcohol mellows. And look, this goes for all store-bought. It's not ideal, nowhere near the real eggnog. But if you're in a pinch, and you maybe want to baby step into the real eggnog raw version, buy some virgin eggnog, take it home, add some alcohol, but let it chill in the refrigerator for a week or two. It's going to be delicious. Okay, let's get to the main event. Making raw eggnog could not be more simple. I need an electric mixer. I need the ingredients. I mix egg yolk and sugar, slowly add in the dairy, slowly add in alcohol, add spices, put in a mason jar, put it in the fridge. It's that simple. I'll provide Jack with a traditional eggnog recipe for notes. Let's talk about why I think eggnog is often misunderstood. I've watched tons of how-tos on YouTube. I tend to think they're all of a replicate of themselves. The alcohol in the eggnog wants to break apart the milk into whey, because it likes to bond with both fat and water things inside the milk. The whey in the milk and cream look like an easy target, but all that dairy is emulsified with sugar and fats from the yolk, so the alcohol takes what it can each time you shake it. This is where the mouthfeel of the creaminess comes from, and of course, tons of fat left over from the cream and yolk. I've yet to have a chemist argue about my theory, but it's food for thought. If you're worried about getting sick, then I recommend not making it. This is always at your own risk. The FDA, USDA all recommend not to consume raw eggs, especially if you're young, old, pregnant. The government is always right. Obey. Now for me, here's why I feel safe. You've got to make sure that your alcohol by volume to the end product is above 20%. You're keeping it in the refrigerator under 40 degrees Fahrenheit. You've cleaned and sterilized your tools and jars before making the nog. And if you're using pasteurized eggs, it's even more safe. And the longer you let it age, the safer it gets. With all these factors, it's like a hostile work environment if there were any salmonella bacteria. Eventually, they just give up. Could there be a chance you screwed up? Sure. This is at your own risk. In fact, working with dirty kitchen equipment is more likely to cause salmonella than the egg itself. Okay, let's talk about variations, because this is where it can get fun. I love traditional, but I tend to experiment. This year's experiments are as follows. Earl Grey infused eggnog with honey and Old Tom gin, chai tea eggnog with rum, bourbon espresso eggnog using, and I'm planning to use hollow roast coffee, especially Jack's bourbon cooled Sumatra. I think it's flavor stacking at its best, and I think that's going to be an absolute delicious coffee eggnog variation. Lastly, some say the potency of the alcohol in the eggnog is too intense. When made correctly, it should be. It's the alcohol and time that make it safer and more delicious. But yes, when you compare it to its virgin store-bought brother, it can be intimidating, especially if it's your first time trying real eggnog. To lighten the eggnog, if you so choose, I pour one serving of eggnog into a shaker tin or even a mason jar with a lid. I add one egg white and half an ounce of honey. I shake vigorously and I serve chilled. I'd recommend getting started on these eggnogs soon if you'd like to enjoy them on Christmas Day. But nog can be created throughout the year and also enjoyed during the cold season. Try and age some until next year if you're actually brave enough. I hope this gets you excited about eggnog. There will be a ton more on the website, including tips, tricks, and recipes. Until next time, this is Ken with DrinkEatLearn.com. Cheers.
So a few things. One, if you need to be told that it's safe to eat a raw egg, you need to go find whoever told you it wasn't and tell them to stop talking to you. If it was not safe to consume eggs raw, I would be dead a long time ago, and so would a lot of other people. I don't know if humans would have existed on the planet for as long as we did, because the first time humans figured out what an egg was, people have been eating them raw. I'm not saying you can't do stupid things with raw eggs and get yourself sick. I'm saying a properly handled egg, especially a homestead, fresh-produced egg, handled properly is not going to make you sick. And if you have a bad egg, you're going to know that you have a bad egg. And you certainly aren't going to do anything with it making a nog, like Ken said, and end up with a bad egg. Number two is with the nog, anti-nogger, pro-nogger, anti-nogger thing is. So this is this thing that happens on Bitcoin Twitter every year. And it's now X. I keep saying Twitter. But Gun X or Gun Twitter, where there are people with very strong emotions about Nog being pro or anti-Nog, and they kind of play on the racist stuff, and sometimes the memes actually invoke pictures from a certain time in America, like Noggers welcome, you know, Noggers not welcome, things like that. It's all in fun, but sometimes it pushes the boundary of what, you know, fun really is. But there are people with this very distinctive hatred, loathing of Nog. And again, it's all in good fun. But I do believe most of them have never actually had eggnog. What they've had is some disgusting egg-like substance that was produced with high fructose corn syrup sold by a grocery store. And that is not the same thing. And I encourage you to make a batch of eggnog this year. And now would be a good time if you want to serve it around Christmas. Make a couple gallons of the stuff and have one for Christmas and age the other one until next year. Yes, you can age it that long. You really can if you do it the way that Ken told you. On that, Ken has three recipes, two kind of experimental new ones, and then the one very traditional one. He sent me a PDF, and I've uploaded it to our server. And in the show notes today, right next to Ken Daniels' segment, it says Nog Recipes. And if you click on that, you can get those recipes. He suggests making it with rum. I think that's a fine idea, but I like it with bourbon. I'm just saying, it's bourbon and eggnog kind of go together really, really, really well. Getting that higher ABV is probably a good idea, and if whatever you're using is a little lower than what he recommends, you can just increase it and do the math, get the same amount of alcohol. I'm just saying, it'll work. It'll be fine. The other thing is, I didn't mention this when Ken Berry was talking, but he mentioned something called Keterade. That video is actually 6 years old, but it took me 3 seconds on Google to find it, so I added it to his segment too. So if you want to know how to make Keterade or Nog, both of those are in the show notes today. And Nick Ferguson will now talk to you about guerrilla gardening.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for Brad on guerrilla gardening. Question for Nick Ferguson: what food-bearing plant would you plant along a nature trail? Details: I have a house in a suburb of Houston, Texas, USDA Zone 8B. This is a master plan community with miles of wooded trail. I would like to guerrilla plant the trail with something that people walking along the trail could enjoy. Think about going out for a morning walk and stopping along the trail to pick some blackberries, as an example. I'm not talking about picking a pint, just a few here and there. More info, the trail is a concrete sidewalk, the edges are lightly maintained, there's generally at least 25 feet of unmaintained woods on each side of the trail until you get to a privacy fence. Some places are heavily wooded, others are more open, lots of pine trees, so lots of pine needles. There are hungry critters of all kinds, deer, raccoon, possums, rat, squirrels, mice, birds, they like everything we do. Yep. This is information to help me, to help tell me what to avoid. As an example, maybe a deer will browse a mulberry until it's dead, but there would be zero return on effort versus a blackberry, where they may eat the fruit but leave the plant itself alone, so at least there's a chance that someone gets a blackberry. A honey badger plant that produces year after year with zero to low maintenance, plant it and forget it. Something easy to propagate, the idea would be to take cuttings from a plant, go on a walk, and stop every so often to open the ground with a hand shovel, drop a cutting in, and then walk away. Also, is this even a good idea, or would this just be a waste of time? And he has attached a screenshot of a satellite image of the trail. Brad. Brad, I think it's a great idea. I'm not so sure you're going to be able to just snag a cutting and shove it in the ground. Timing and normally some babying of a cutting are necessary. However, there are a few things that you might be able to get away with doing that. The handful of plants that immediately spring to mind are going to be the easiest to propagate via hardwood cuttings I can hear Jack in my head right now yelling goji berry. That one is super simple to propagate. And you could put those plants all over the place in that kind of area. As long as they get enough sunlight, they're going to like the edge environment a lot. They're low growing. Another one that you could shove winter cuttings in, you know, all over the place, just jab them in the ground, would be fig. They're pretty much stick it and forget it. I'd go with something like Celeste, but honestly, if you have them, throw a handful of cultivars all over the place for a variety. Another few plants I can see doing well, that they're probably going to require transplanting as established plants, are going to be, like you mentioned, blackberry, blueberry. I'd go with very low chill blueberries since you're in Houston, and I'd go with thorny upright cultivars of blackberries, not the thornless trailing ones. And then I would look into some of the ever-bearing mulberries. Those should do really well down there, and they should be fairly easy to propagate and grow down there. Yeah, the deer might hammer them, but I mean, if the cuttings are pretty much free, just a little bit of effort, then it might be worth getting those thrown all over the place as well. The nice thing is, with the blackberry, you can tip root those easily at home. Just wrap the rooted cuttings in paper, whatever kind of rooted cuttings that you're doing. You could wrap them in a little bit of paper in some moist potting mix, and you could set a dozen of those in a plastic baggie, just like in your pocket or in a bag, and then just grab that kind of paper liner pot and trowel them into the ground quickly and easily, and that paper should just disintegrate in a couple weeks, and then the roots will just boom, shoot right out. So some of the things just to keep in mind, if you want to get any fruit from these plants, they will need to be in areas that get plenty of sunlight, and you should also make sure to do a little guerrilla maintenance, like kicking extra mulch around the base of each plant to reduce competition, and also throw a handful of fertilizer down a few times in the summer to help those food producers out a bit. And then you might want to also bring a pair of pruning shears to help thin things out to prevent them from just getting choked out by weeds and other weedy tree species. Best of luck. It sounds like your location would actually be fantastic for something like that, judging by the satellite imagery. All right, remember, guys, January 1st, the Rare Plant Store tree packs are ready to order, and this year I just might have some nice berry bush packs available as well. I hope everyone's year is shaping up with a nice positive end. Keep the good questions coming. I'm Nick Ferguson. Do good things.
Yeah, he's right on me screaming goji. Yeah, absolutely. Specifically in springtime, as long as you have softwood cuttings of goji in springtime and you have a moist area, it almost can't fail. Throw three in a spot where you want one, and all three will probably make it, but one definitely will. All right, let's go on and cover my segment today, which is going to be on, hey, Bitcoin at 100K. And before I go on, I am aware that sometimes prices go up and back down, and just because it was still at 100K this morning doesn't mean it's at 100K now, though it doesn't change much in my answer here. I am going to pull it up. $100,830 of Bitcoin. So down a little bit from where it was this morning. Up 6.16% over the last 24 hours. Meaning that if you hold one Bitcoin right now, you are a tenth of a millionaire. Good for you. And if you hold five of them, you're 50% a millionaire, etc. Right? So it's easy to do the math now that we've hit this. I want to talk about this without overselling the significance and without underselling the significance. Bitcoin's future, in my opinion, is inevitable. I recently posted something on X that made a lot of the gold bugs and other fiat tards very angry. And gnash their teeth and yell at me and tell me how stupid I was. And I said, the older I get and the more financially conservative I get, the larger percentage of my investments I put in Bitcoin or something. I'm paraphrasing myself. Basically, that's what I said. And I was told how dumb I am. It's not real money because real money is not volatile. And maybe it's not Bitcoin that's volatile, folks. Maybe it's the underlying currency we're pricing it in that's really volatile. But volatility is to be expected in a new asset class, especially if it's trying to demonetize other asset classes over time. We are early. We are only a little over, 14, 15 years into this. And we have only really had, something that people have been willing to even consider is valid for about 10-ish years, depending on who you talk to. For many, it's more like 5 years. This is early days. If we're comparing it to the internet, it's about 1995 right now, just to put it in perspective. So there will be more volatility. But there are different things that affect the price of an asset that's traded on an open market. And some of them are structural, and some of them are mental and emotional. And there are certain barriers that are mental and emotional that once they're crossed, people stop having a problem with the barrier and are willing to go beyond it. In some ways, it's like something you would think that is completely immune to that, which is physical accomplishments. There was a time when the 4-minute mile seemed insurmountable. It would never be broken. People tried, and they're coming at 402, 403, 402 and a half. And people had just kind of accepted that the fastest a human being could possibly travel a mile in on their feet was just over 4 minutes, and then somebody broke it. And then almost every competitor that runs the mile in competition today at any kind of a high level breaks it today. Everybody does it. Now, not every human, but everybody that's that level of competitor. If you can't run a 4-minute mile, then you're not, what they would call a middle distance competitive runner at any significant level today. Maybe high school in certain places, but, you're going to, even collegiately, most of these guys can do this today. Well, did human beings magically metamorphosize since I think it was the 60s when it was first broken? It was the 50s or the 60s? No. They're the same people we all are. I would say that the average person was in better physical shape when the 4-minute mile was broken than they are today. And elite athletes today are training at a higher level. I'll give you that. But it wasn't like it took 30 years for a whole bunch of people. Like, it was just bang, bang. People just started doing it left and right as soon as the mental barrier was broken. There are certain numbers for Bitcoin that have been that. $1,000 was it, $10,000 was it, $25,000 was one of them, $50,000 was one of them, and $100,000 was definitely one of them. There was enough volume trading for a scarce asset for this to have happened a few weeks earlier than it did, but it didn't. And it's because there was a large sell wall, and there was a mental block to paying, close to $100,000 or $100,000 or more for Bitcoin. sooner or later the inevitable in something like this occurs, and that number is broken. And when that number is broken, it stops being a mental barrier, and it then will go. Now, am I saying it won't be $98,000 tomorrow? No. It could be $94,000 tomorrow, and I won't care. That's just where we are and kind of how we got here. Where we go from here, you now have the most successful company, if we look at their rise in stock price and the strength of their balance sheet, probably on the stock exchange, is MicroStrategy, who adopted a Bitcoin strategy about 4 years ago. It looks like Microsoft is going to pick up and do it too, and it may be what prevents Bitcoin from overtaking their market cap in the next 2, 3, 4 years. What am I going to do, and what do I advise you to do? If you've been a good hodler, you've been saving your Bitcoin, and now you're sitting here looking at $100,000 Bitcoin at an all-time high. I'll tell you what I told my wife this morning when she said, well, should we sell some of it now? No. No. Every time I've ever sold a Satoshi, I've regretted it. And every time I haven't bought one, I've regretted it. And every one time I've spent one without replacing it or spending it into existence, I'll talk about that in a second, I've regretted it. If you would like right now, I could go make a live video for you. I could go upstairs into my gun room and I could bring down a very beautiful pre-World War II Belgian-made Browning A5 auto shotgun that's worth about $2,100 that effectively now I paid $100,000 for. Because I bought it for one Bitcoin when Bitcoin was about $600 and the gun was worth about $1,100 at the time. And do I regret it? Yeah. I would if somebody said, I'll give you a Bitcoin, you know, the guy I gave the Bitcoin to, if he'd rebate me, would I take? Yeah. And it is what it is. I've been doing this since 2013, and with some level of, you know, real intent since 2014. I probably have more Bitcoin than most people and probably less than most people think I do, because there was a time when I thought I was smarter and I'm going to trade here and sell this and, you know, get this shit coin and invest in this operation that's doing mining and spend some Bitcoin on it to get more Bitcoin. And there are times that it worked out fantastically well. There are times where I played around when Wall Street Silver was pumping Doge and I made a few thousand dollars in a few days off of basically fun money. And it's worked out really, and there's times where it's bit me in the ass. And all I can tell you is if I had taken every dime that I ever fucked around with crypto with and bought Bitcoin with it and simply hodled and never soddled, that I would be much better off than I am today. In fact, I would be so much better off that I would probably live in a different place and I would be coming to you from a place I would at least jokingly call Jackistan. So I've done really, really well, but I could have done a lot better. So I'm just advising you to do what I've learned the hard way as being part of, I would officially call myself class of 2014, and that is hodl, never soddle. And I will tell you what's going to happen. We are not done with this cycle yet. We are not at the high for the cycle. It will go probably a great deal higher, and then it will retract. And there is every possibility in the world that you could see it go up to something like 200,000 and come back down to 80 and languish in $70,000 to $80,000, and all the retards are going to tell you it crashed again, and they'll all be wrong again, and then there'll be another cycle because mathematics. Now, there's also the possibility, I'm not saying probably, the possibility that this run could go on much longer than they typically do in the four-year cycle because of everything that has happened in the interim. Everything that's happened in the interim. We have a different world that we live in today. There are 11 Bitcoin ETFs. Combined, they're holding almost, I would, right now they're holding about 1/40th of all Bitcoin that will ever be. Odds are by the end of next year, they'll hold about 1/20th of all Bitcoin that will ever be, roughly 1 million units. You got MasterLink holding on to 407,000 Bitcoin. Okay, that's roughly 1/60th of all Bitcoin that will ever be. You've got companies like Microsoft with their board of directors voting on whether or not to take on a Bitcoin standard and having at least been willing to take a presentation in from Michael Saylor explaining why they should do it, and it was quite compelling. that presentation could have any company's name put on instead of Microsoft, and a few of the graphs that are Microsoft graphs taken out and that company's graphs put in, and it could be given to every Fortune 500 company in the nation, and it would be just as valid. This is the way forward. This is the monetary asset of the future. The Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, soon to not be the Federal Reserve Chairman when his term is up, and maybe earlier if there is a way to get rid of him, because there is a big desire by the Trump administration to get that Keebler elf the fuck out of that position, though I don't know if it's possible, recently said that Bitcoin is digital gold. He said it's digital gold. And he said it is not a competitor to the dollar, it's a competitor to gold. The gold has like a $14 trillion market cap. Bitcoin is just about to move into $2 trillion market cap territory. Put that in your pipe and smoke it, Peter Schiff. And it is a new asset. It is still going forward. The thing is, what Powell is saying is copium. It's cope. Yes, Bitcoin is a competitor to gold as a financial asset. It's also a competitor to the dollar. The dollar defeated gold, one, by demonetizing gold, right? So the United States government demonetized gold fully in 71, partially in 33, and demonetized silver in both 1873 and 1964. But that's only part of the problem. The reason they were able to actually do it and get it work wasn't just because they said it was illegal to own gold, because people own shit that's illegal. Go out and buy some drugs right now that you're not supposed to have. It ain't hard. The reason was that people wanted their money to be portable and secure. They wanted to have both portability and security. They wanted to be able to pay a bill by signing a piece of paper and mailing it to somebody, and eventually they wanted to be able to do it by swiping a card or pushing a button on a computer. And the problem with gold is it doesn't work that way. It can't work that way. It's not going to work that way. And it was actually really easy to make sure that even though possibly maybe in some way it could sort of work that way, that it became completely unusable by America, with American citizens, which is the largest economy in the world, effectively fully and completely demonetizing gold and making it nothing but a reserve financial asset. Okay? That's what happened. Now keep in mind, I'm using no notes here. This is a redneck duck farmer talking to you, not a PhD with a degree in economics. And yet I can tell you all this. Why? Because I've put in hundreds of hours of research into learning about these things on all sides of it. And it doesn't mean I'm a genius or anything. It just means that I have taken the work that other people have done and absorbed it so that I can repeat it back to you in a way that's condensed and hopefully makes sense. What makes Bitcoin a competitor to gold and the dollar is its ability to move through space and time at literally the speed of light. And for all the talk about, it's expensive, you can't buy a coffee and a scone, I don't know where all these people are lining up to buy scones with Bitcoin that can't afford to do it. I've never met one. Maybe there's one out there somewhere. And if it was that was the real problem, then something like Litecoin or Bitcoin Cash or any of these other cryptos that are faster and cheaper to send would have taken over a long time ago, and they haven't. Because the whole concept of it being expensive is a lie. People don't spend it because it's a deflationary currency, and they know the longer they hold it, the more it's worth. That's why. And it's not expensive to move Bitcoin. If I want to move $1,000 worth of Bitcoin or $1,000 in U.S. dollars, and I want them both to go to Tokyo, it costs me less money, less time, and less effort to move the Bitcoin than it does the dollar. So shut up. It's a lie. It's all lies. It's always been lies. Now, would it be great if there was a cheap way to buy $5 worth of shit with Bitcoin? Sure it would, and there is. It's called Lightning. It's called Liquid. It's called Cashew. It's called eCash, and it continues to grow and develop, and it continues to get easier and easier to do. And eventually, and I would say within the next year or two, a person that doesn't know jack shit compared to what I know about all this stuff is going to be able to just get a wallet and use it. And it'll be on one of those protocols, probably with a Lightning base and maybe one of the other protocols. And it won't look any different than using Cash App. And you already can do it. It's just that you're KYC and you're not self-custody with, you know, things like Strike or even Primal, which is a Nostr app, can be your Lightning wallet. And you can buy Bitcoin at $5 off the fucking Apple store in Primal right now. There is no problem with low-cost purchases with Bitcoin. It doesn't exist, but the government will know I did it. And when you go use your fucking Visa card at Starbucks, the government knows you did that too. Shut up. Quit coming up with excuses and reasons not to be involved. So if you've hodled up to 100K, keep doing it and keep DCAing. Keep buying more. And when it goes down, buy more. And when it goes down even more, buy more. And when it goes down even more, buy more. And when it goes up, buy more. And hold and hold and hold. And the only time you should be thinking about divesting of your Bitcoin at all is an absolute financial emergency, because that's what reserves are for, or when you actually maybe start spending it in your actual retirement, and hopefully you'll be able to figure out ways by then to not actually sell it and derive a cash flow off it from debt. Or right now, don't take this word the wrong way. There isn't a place I would recommend you do this right now. But in the future, we may have ways to derive yield from the Bitcoin that you hold that are actually safe and not using some scam service like Celsius or some bullshit that, you know, bankrupted thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And we will, it is the most pristine form of capital, and it is the most pristine and trustworthy financial asset in the world. And so more and more will be developed for it and on top of it. For those of you that remember when I was a shit coiner, all I'll say here is what got me to completely divest of shit coining was two things. One, Michael Saylor's words got through to me. But more importantly, when I saw people building on top of Bitcoin, and I saw that literally there is not another cryptocurrency that anybody's building on top of. They're using one crypto to build another crypto for another twist on a crypto so you can leverage crypto and DeFi crypto to buy more crypto and bet on. No, fuck all that. When I saw people actually building social media on top of Bitcoin, not integrating Bitcoin into social media, building on top of it. When I saw people building podcast apps on top of Bitcoin and Lightning, where I can interact with my audience, that we can exchange value for value, and all the other cryptos were going to do all this wonderful shit, never did a fucking thing, it was over. And the reality is, the part that Michael Saylor had clicked for me was, there really can only be one. There will only be one winner in the end. And this is the winner. So what should you do? Winner, winner, chicken dinner, keep your chicken, don't spend it. All right? Anyway, that's what I'm going to do. I put out a poll today. Let's check in on that poll real quick. I pinned it to the top of my profile just to see what the audience has to say, at least those that follow me on X. And I said, now that Bitcoin has hit 100K, what do you do next? I know my answer. What's yours? Pay off debt, 2.3% said that. Retire, 2.7%. Sell high, buy back later, 8.1% of people who probably are the real fools. And then stay humble and stack sats, 86.9%. If you ask the audience here, the audience, as usual, gives you the right answer. There's still 20 hours to vote on that poll on X. If you want to jump over on my profile and vote there, it is pinned to the top. If you follow me on X and think I don't post there, it's because I'm shadow banned on X. I do it anyway because people have learned, you know, you can make a list of the people you want to follow, and then you will see them. I'll just say that. But you could also get on Nostr. You can get on Nostr, and then you can do things like, you know, actually see the people you follow and actually say what you think. I tried to tell somebody something they said was retarded today on X, and I kept getting community violations and had to change the word to a word that somebody would understand as retard, but apparently Grok's AI that's now doing all this shit couldn't. It's ridiculous. The fact that you go on social, and I don't care if it's X, Facebook, whatever, you go on there today and you see people say, you know, the assassination attempt, and they have to spell assassination differently so they don't get flagged, that tells you you don't have free speech. There is free speech if you want it, and there is real money if you want it. It's up to you to take it. Soapbox done. I've been asked to do a Bitcoin breakout on this. Consider that a mini one. I probably won't do another Bitcoin breakout until January of next year. With that, I am ready to wrap up. Let me remind you again, guys, if you like the show and the work that we do, there's a couple ways that you can really help us out. One of those ways is to do your online shopping at tspaz.com. I did the items of the day or the week already today, so I won't do them again. Just remember you can do that. And I really appreciate when you do. You can also become a member of the Member Support Brigade. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members or /members. Sign up there. It's $50 a year. Use the discounts. Get your money back. I mean, how many people actually do this? Let me ask you that. Of all the podcasts that have Patreons and memberships and all, how many of them actually say, look, my membership's inexpensive. It's $50 a year. That's 20 cents an episode. But if you use the membership, you get all your money back. And in fact, many people profit several hundred dollars a year off of it. So if you're not a member, consider becoming one. Give it to yourself for Christmas. And check out Home Food Systems. The cover crop course and the composting courses have been very popular and very well received. The principle-based design course is absolutely free. I'm just going to say, if you are interested in the other courses and you haven't registered for the principle-based design course, something might happen on Monday and you might want to get your ass over there and register for the principle-based design course now. Because if you don't, you won't even know when it happens, and then nothing good will come of it. If you already have registered for any of the courses, you don't need to worry about what I just said. With that, I wish you a great weekend, because tomorrow will be a Friday flashback, and I'll be back next week. We are back to regular scheduled programming right up to Christmas week, and so we'll stick with that through the end of the year. Take care, guys.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.